Hey, everybody. Welcome to our podcast. I'm John
Hewlett. First one.
Yeah, first one. Favaz and myself. And we're doing this thing called the Casey Tapes. We're going to go back and dig up some old interviews we've done over the years with various artists. Some of them rock artists. Most of them rock artists.
Yeah.
And some are, athletes or,
You just made me think of Evander Holyfield in Greece when I interviewed him.
You did?
Yeah.
I didn't know you did that. Was that before the ear got bit off or
it
after?
It was after. And I sat behind him at a track and field event at the Olympics that evening, and I was on the side with his ear. I was with Tony Buzicruz, and I was like, look at his ear. That's the ear. And then we had to race back and interview him at like 11. It was just crazy. You just made me think of that.
Yeah, one of the most famous ears in the history of humanity, and you were sitting right next to it. Wow. Yeah, so you never know who we'll be able to dig up from the past because we're going through a bunch of old tapes.
Because John's been here for 42 years, and I've been here for 27. So between the two of us, we got some shit.
42, 52, 62. That's 69 years worth of interviews.
That's impressive.
All right.
Tell everybody why we're doing a podcast, John.
Because it's the thing to do in the business these days.
Because we have to.
Yeah. Well, that and we've all realized here at the radio station that there is a gold mine of past interviews and information that this station has locked up in our vaults. This is a good way to free them up.
Absolutely. And I will say that, we had a meeting a couple months ago, and we had a program director from our Cincinnati station on with us talking about podcasts, remember? And he was the one that said the interviews online in the Hall of Fame and all that, and he didn't know, what we have, besides. He was like, that's a gold mine for a podcast. And that's where the idea started between you and I. We're like, okay, let's pull one out of the Hall of Fame and do it. And then we're like, oh my God, I've got all these and you've got all these. And it just kind of went from there. So I don't remember his name. Do you remember that guy's name?
I don't.
Sorry. Yeah, he's a program director in Cincinnati at a Hubbard Station High.
Yeah, nice man.
It's your fault. So
and actually, some of this started, back for our 50th anniversary when I was going through basement tapes and finding things I did not realize that I had.
Right.
And I thought, well, I don't know what I'll do with these. I don't know if anybody's going to have any interest in these or whatever. But then all of a sudden, this fella comes up with this podcast idea, and we're like, well,
I think it's a great idea.
I know where there are a bunch of tapes,
and they're in various forms. As John said, he has some on reel-to-reel, which is the old-style tape where it's on one side and you play it through and it goes to the other side. I have some on reel-to-reel, mini disc. So we've had to have the engineers put a mini disc player in here. Also, a DAT, digital audio tape.
Right.
We have to have a machine in here for that. And then I have a bunch just on the computer.
Yeah, and some are on CD discs.
Yeah, some are on, like the Evander Holyfield, I believe. Well, I think I have that on CD, but maybe on mini discs. So, they're on various. Yeah. It kind of just shows the technology that we have to work with, how it has changed over the years.
Yeah. And the challenge for me right now on this reel-to-reel machine, which I got from the radio station, which was sitting in the studios.
You stole it.
Well, I didn't steal
it. Did they give it to you?
They did give it to me.
Wow.
So I set it up in my basement. And I'm listening to these tapes, and I'm not kidding. Every 2 or 3 minutes of listening, I got to stop the machine and clean the heads off with alcohol.
You're kidding.
Because the tapes are so oxidized.
Oh, wow.
They're filthy, and they're making the heads filthy.
Do they break? Because I'm worried that some of mine might, like the tape might just split.
No, and there are a lot of edits in some of them where, when you edited that old tape, you did it with splicing tape, it was called. But they're holding up real good when I'm fast-forwarding and rewinding and everything. So I would have thought that sticking tape, that's the splicing tape, would be brittle by now. But it's not. But the tapes themselves are filthy. So every so often I got to clean it off, and it's very frustrating.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I hope the machine here is good. Because
it's going to have the same problems. It's going to have the same problem.
So
anyway, the one we're going to do today, the interview we're doing today, was not recorded back in the times of reel-to-reel machines. You did this one in 2002, right, with Sammy Hagar.
Actually, I believe it was 2006, I think. We've both interviewed Sammy a million times. The reason we're doing this particular one, this was the interview that I inducted him into the Casey Hall of Fame on our online museum at KC95.com. And we thought we'd pick this one out because, we want you to go to the museum and check out all the interviews. But the Hall of Fame is really cool. It's unique. Yeah. As far as I know, no other radio station has a Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And while Sammy wasn't the first to be inducted, he was one of the first, and I think you'll hear here, he might have been one of the first three that were inducted. And, yeah, so I did the interview at the pageant.
Well, I was giving Favaz some trouble, too, because back in the late 70s when Sammy first started coming to St. Louis, and in through the early 80s when he came to town, I generally was the one that would interview him.
Right.
And I ended up having a decent rapport with him, and I got some great photos of me in the old Casey Studios in Crestwood with Sammy when he came. One of them is us both looking. I mean, we were both in our 20s probably, and we both got this big old smile on our face in this photo, which, by the way, was
Instamatic.
It was taken with an Instamatic, yeah. And we got these big, full mustaches, man, just just jumping out of the picture for practically. And so I kid Favaz, I said, you stole him from me. Because
well, let me
after
tell you,
a while, he started always gravitating towards you. I don't know what happened.
Well,
there,
no, he started, I think the first time I interviewed him was somewhere around 98. And he started to do interviews in the afternoon. So when he started to do those, I do afternoon drive. So I was the guy that happened to be there. And then he and I developed a rapport and did all those broadcasts down in Cabo for his birthday.
You really got up close and personal with guy over you. He considers you one of his good friends, I think.
I think he does. But people still, they think that when I go to Cabo, I hang out at his house and stuff like that. That does not happen. Yeah. I mean, there is a line between, you know, friendship and a DJ rock star relationship.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't cross it because out of respect. Now, if Sammy wanted to have me at his house, I'd be happy to go and drink his tequila and stuff like that. And could I, you know, could I reach out to him? You know, I could. I do have his phone number and stuff like that. But I would never dream to do that. He'll reach out to me and say, hey, I'm promoting something. You know, that because Sammy's a, you know, Sammy knows how to sell, an entrepreneur. He knows how to sell things. But, you know, it's not that kind of relationship like we're buds and, you know, we go to dinner, although we have been to dinner here in town. But he doesn't, like when he's in town, he's like, hey, we got to go to dinner. It doesn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. So. Oh, had me fooled, too. but, I mean, you have been in the dressing room at private times.
I have.
You? Yeah,
I have.
Did you have a story about that? Did you tell a story about that on the stage from the window?
The amphitheater?
Yeah.
Oh, from the window? No, I did not tell any Sammy stories like that. I told David Lee Roth story.
Oh, that's right. It was David Lee Roth.
You mean when I smoked a joint with David Lee Roth, John? Is that what you're trying to get?
I get my Van Halen
I do
singers.
Have an interview with him that we'll do sometime on the show.
Okay.
But no, Sammy, the only thing, if you're going down that road, the only thing that I've ever done with Sammy is shoot tequila with him.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I was in his office, if you will, down in Cabo in 2002. And I remember I walked in to do an interview and he goes, Favaz, you're so dark. You look like a Mexican. And I was so strung out because it was like on the last night of, you know, it was just an idiot down there. I drank every day a fool. And I did. I was sunburned and I sat there and we sipped tequila and we had one of the many interviews. So, but I never smoked a joint with him.
No, the cantina looks like a penis. Doesn't it? I mean,
yes, the light tower does.
Yes, yes.
If you go down there, it does. And we should say Sammy's birthday is Saturday, and he's going to be 71 years old, and he's doing shows there this week.
Yeah.
And he doesn't do as many as he used to do. And the cantina is small; it only holds, I think, 500 people, and that's why those tickets were always in such demand, you know, to go to one of those shows because it was. You're going to be only one of 500 people there. And so cantina's cool. But, yes, the lighthouse looks like a giant dick.
Yeah.
And there's no other way around it.
Do you think that was on
it.
Purpose?
I don't know if he did it. I don't think so because, you know, you're practically on the ocean. You're on the Sea of Cortez right there. You know, there are lighthouses everywhere.
Yeah.
And maybe they all look like dicks. I don't know.
This has a ring around the top to add to the...
The color is... let's see. The color is not a flesh tone, should we say. I don't think it is. Yeah. It's a lighter color, though. All right, so here's the interview with Sammy, and this was done at the pageant after a show where he wasn't feeling so great. He is mic'd. So you'll be able to hear him really well. For me, though, you're going to have to probably listen a little harder or turn up your whatever you're listening to this podcast on because I'm not mic'd. You can hear me But you know, I'm lower. So, you know, we, the interview's about 8 minutes long, and John and I will come out on the backside and we'll wrap things up and talk about what we heard too. So hit it.
Can I be? Actually, I'd rather sit in a regular chair, because this here I'm going to sit back too far.
Okay.
So, now everyone realizes people are going to have to shut up. Johnny, you realize you're going to have to shut up. I'll go in the other room. Because I'm not going to do this again.
Hey, Sammy, I want to tell you what it's about. It's kind of like 60 Minute style. I'm going to be off to the side.
Yeah.
And we're creating a real rock museum.
Let me go ahead and button this.
We're creating a real rock museum online. People go, and it'll be different wings of the museum and stuff. One of the wings is going to be an artist wing where people will click on their favorite artists talking about their favorite St. Louis memory, their Keishi memories, the artists. So I'll lead you a shit, and then you can look at me.
Here?
You can look at the camera or whatever.
Don't go too close. Don't go too far. Let's try this.
We're rolling?
We're rolling.
Okay. All right. Sammy Hagar, when I say St. Louis, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
It's almost painful. It's almost painful. It's like trying to, in my heart, you know, because I care so much about the fans, trying to live up to a show after show after show after show is actually, it's so stressful. I love the city so much. Every time I play, I want to do the greatest performance I've ever done in my life. And maybe once or twice out of the 35 times I played here, whatever it is, you know better than me, Fafaz. Ask Fafaz how many times I played here. I probably walked away going, all right. You know, most of the time I'm going, oh, I wish I did this, wish I'd have done that, you know. And tonight, other than being able to, other than not being able to sing because I was sick, it was one of the greatest nights I've ever had here. That audience was 1,500 people, sounded louder than sold out Busch Stadium to me.
So right there, you ask him about you know, his memories of playing in St. Louis, and he talks about how stressful it is to play here. Were you ever around him right before he went on stage for one of his big shows here? Because it sounds to me like he gets all, you know, nervous.
He, you know, the only time I can really remember him being nervous and uptight, and it was obvious to me, was just a year ago at the Keishi 50th anniversary show, because it was a big show for him. And he was kind of uptight, and even his manager had told me. And the reason he was so nervous, you know, for that show, he really wanted it to come off well.
Yeah.
He knew it was the Keishi anniversary. He knew he was the headliner. Collective Soul was playing. ZZ Top played that night. You know, it was a big deal to him. And I can't really say before, you know, all the other times I was with him, and I was with him right, like, as he was walking on the stage to Cabo and to play like that. Nothing, you know, ever, you know, struck me as, wow, he's nervous. But that one did.
Yeah, because, you know? Well, he's been here so many times. You wonder how he has to wonder himself, how do I keep topping what I've done before? Because he's put on some great shows in the past.
Right.
That adds to the stress factor.
Absolutely. And like you said, he played like 35 times or whatever. It's the truth. You know, if you count all the Van Halen shows, I mean, he's got a lot to live up to. And it's easy to see why he would want to better the next show than the one that he just did. Let's get back to the interview.
Do you remember the first time you ever set foot this town? Was that
Not really. I'm sure it was Montrose. I remember going to Keishi and getting the pig shirt at Montrose, and we all came on stage that night with, all wearing a pig shirt with the headphones. I remember that, much of it, but I don't remember the show, and I don't remember that. I remember playing here before as an opening act for Ted Nugent, Boston. I can't remember who else. I think I played here one time with Angel, like a dollar concert or something like that, at one of the smaller 10,000-seat arenas, you know. But it seems like in St. Louis I never played the small places. I was always an arena act, either as an opening act or whatever. But to me, if I just think of, okay, how did it happen in St. Louis? You know, when did it happen? I opened for Boston. No, excuse me. I opened for Ted Nugent. And it was a big deal. I came back with Boston like 2 weeks later. Yeah, at the Checker Dome. And I got three encores. And Tom Scholz is standing on the side stage. Tom's a great guy, but he don't like the opening act doing too good, you know. And I always did really good, but, you know, he kept going. I'm walking off the side of the stage. It's like, ah! He's going, go do another one. Did three encores, and I think that was the last time I was an opening act in St. Louis.
Because then in November, you played with Pat Travers and the Scorpions, and that was the show at the Checker Dome that was broadcast all over the nation.
That's right. That was the MTV thing where, yeah, Pat Travers and the Scorpions.
This was before MTV. This was still 79.
No, okay, when did we...
You did the MTV thing around 80.
Oh, okay, that was before that.
That was three lock box, I think.
Listen, I own a tequila company, folks. I do drink. Yeah, but then we did the MTV concert here at the Checker Dome, and I was already happening. That was 83. Right. That was Three Lock Box, and had a great production, and they filmed it on MTV. And that, when I watched that thing, I'm going, what is wrong with that guy? I'm looking at myself going, why does he just keep moving and running and jumping and doing, you know, slow down, pal.
So, you know, Sammy was just talking about opening for Ted Nugent. I was at that show. And I remember the date. I'm so weird. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It was December 6th, 1978. Yeah. And it was my first arena rock show. And it was my first really introduction to Sammy Hagar. Mm-hmm. And I remember he owned the crowd. Yeah. He owned the crowd that night. And so much so, fast forward to whatever year, Living It Up, the DVD that came out in the 2000s, he had me do the liner notes for the DVD. And when I wrote him, I wrote about that show. It was amazing that night that he opened for Ted and he had the crowd in the palm of his hand. Now, the thing where he was wrong, he didn't come back 2 weeks later and open for Boston. That show was in December. I believe March is when Boston came back, or Boston was there, and Boston was doing, it might have been, what was the second record that came out? Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Back, yeah.
And Sammy opened that show. And I'll never forget Sammy coming back for an encore when the lights were on. Uh-huh. It was unreal. Yeah. Yeah. And you could really tell right there that this guy was something special. And people loved him in St. Louis.
Yeah. Oh, great memories there.
And then I talked about the show where he opened for, or where Pat Travers and the Scorpions opened for him, and it was broadcast. That was broadcast on Casey. I think Ted Habeck might have been the jock that kind of engineered things back, but that was not an MTV show. It was broadcast over, I don't know how many radio stations, and it was Sammy's first time headlining in St. Louis at the old Checker Dome Arena or whatever. And I remember it was like November of 1979.
I also wanted to ask you about nowadays with artists and radio stations, the bond isn't there anymore. Tell us what Casey meant to you in the early days.
Oh, no. There's still a bond here with Casey, and there was in the early days. It's funny because with Montrose, we were like, we had no love. That first Montrose record, it took 10 years to sell 3 million records, but it did. But Casey played Space Station Number 5. It was a hit in this town, I remember. You know, probably played other things, but in this town, I remember a manager going, hey, you got like a hit in St. Louis with, you know, Space Station Number 5. I'm going, what? It's not a single or anything. That bond is really, really important in the town, and we can prove that with what's happened for me and for other bands in this town. I remember back when I first broke this town, Bob Seger was my competition in this town. We were the two, big guys around here. And it was all because of Casey. Honestly, it really was. And Dick Richmond from the Post-Dispatch, Wayne Meisenholder from worked for Capitol, all the people that believed in it, and everyone did their job. But truthfully, the radio was really a big deal. And you guys had another station back then, Katy or something.
It was a KADI.
Yeah, and they also played my singles like on a top 40 level or something. That really, I think it all helped. It's been proven. Otherwise, why am I still, an arena act here, without a hit single for 100 years? You guys wouldn't even if I made a new song, they wouldn't play my new song. They play like, You Love's Driving Me Crazy and stuff, So why would that be, other than the fact that you pound the artist. It's great.
I'll tell you what, I was impressed with the fact that he not only remembered Casey Radio, but he remembered our competition back in the late 70s, KADI. I can't believe he remembered that.
Yeah, that was weird. And, It's a real thing, the bomb in Keshi. That is why he is so successful here. People don't believe that, you know, all these years that he plays out at the amphitheater, you know, 20,000 people, and he'll go to Chicago or Kansas City and play for five.
Yeah.
It's just, the way that it is.
Well, his song, Red, is a song that the Cardinals take the field on at Busch Stadium before, up until, I think, towards the very end of the year.
Right.
That's the one that we would play as the team came out. I mean, and I remember him coming down there and throwing out first pitch a couple times.
I was there that night. The last time, because Montrose, that was when he was here with Montrose, Bill Church, and Denny Carmassi, and Ronnie was still alive then. I don't think Ronnie was there, but the one time he threw out the first pitch, we were all there, and we were with you. You were doing your thing and everything.
I think he's done it twice. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're right.
Yeah, I think it was twice.
I think you're right.
But you know, you're not going to find a nicer, friendlier man in any business, especially somebody who's accomplished what he has accomplished, and still willing to you know, be.
He's very accommodating.
Appreciative.
Yes, he's appreciative. He's accommodating. You know, like in that interview there, I forgot that I was supposed to go on stage, as I'm listening back to this thing after all these years, that I was supposed to, you know, induct him into the Keshi Hall of Fame while he was still on stage at the pageant. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I guess I was supposed to, you know, but instead we did it right there. And you could tell that, yeah, he was like, I deserve this one for sure.
Yeah.
You know, and he's totally right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I say that he's a very nice man because that's what we see from him all the time. But you stop and you think about it over his career, too. He's had to have his run-ins with people. I mean, when he left Montrose, he and Ronnie Montrose weren't friends.
Right.
Of course, the Van Halen situation.
Right.
And I think even one of his business ventures, he parted ways with a partner. So Sammy wants it his way, too.
Absolutely.
And you know what? He's very smart, and he's been successful. So his way must be the right way. So you kind of like back off and let him have his space and let him do what he wants because he's proven he's a winner.
Yeah, he knows what he's doing. And in the interview, he says he owns a tequila company. Well, he does not own that tequila company anymore.
No.
He sold it for about $85 million.
Yeah.
So once again, it just shows that, you know, he's a, you know, he was making bikes and I think T-shirts back in the 60s or 70s. I mean, he's an entrepreneur. He knows what's going on. I did want to clear up one thing. So people are listening now to the Sammy. You know, for years, I know that you know, Sammy said, I want to play a free show under the arch. You know,
right.
Free show. I want to do a free show.
Yeah.
And people don't realize he still gets paid. Okay, it's the people, you know, that come to the show. You don't have to pay anything.
Yeah.
But he still gets paid. Security gets paid. Lighting gets paid. Insurance has to get paid. Where does all this kind of this money come from? You know, it's got to come from somewhere. That's why Sammy never really did a free show up until Fair St. Louis a couple of years ago at Forest Park, which was really, really cool. And that was like the first free show that he ever did. But that's why it never happened under the arch before. It wasn't our fault.
Right.
You know, it was just one of those things. It would have been really cool, but that was the way it was. So,
well, I know there was the bike company that he bought and turned that into a successful venture, the tequila company. And another little known story is he went into business with his brother-in-law and they somehow came up with a device for sprinkler systems. That somehow,
I don't remember that.
Yeah, and supposedly he and his brother-in-law sold that company for millions of dollars too. I mean, everything the guy practically touched
read
turned
his
to
book
gold.
Because
except some of his restaurants, some of his restaurants did close and not do well.
Yes, and if you read his book that came out, you know, five or 6 years ago, whatever, I think it was probably longer than that. He talks about how, you know, back in the day they were dirt poor. You know, him and his family, and that's where he got that entrepreneurial spirit. You know, he started thinking of what could I do this and this, and you know, to this day he's still, you know, he owns a rum company.
Yeah.
You know, now he's moved on from tequila. He made his money off of that. Now he's, you know, Sammy Hagar's Beach Bar Rum.
And when he had his Sammy Hagar Beach Bar here in St. Louis, all the profits for that went to charity, right?
Sure did.
He does a lot of stuff for charity.
Sammy's always given back, you know, and I was with him at a school in North St. Louis for that program, the backpack, something for backpack that he did.
Yeah.
And it was really emotional when all the kids, and I'm pretty sure these kids didn't really realize who Sammy Hagar was.
Right.
I mean, they knew he was a rock star and he was giving them money or whatever. When they met him that day and they all just, you know, got around him and started hugging him and everything, I almost cried.
Yeah.
It was, and he told me he did too. It was just, You know, he really likes to give back.
Yeah.
One of the wings of the museum is a Hall of Fame wing. And we inducted two of your pals already. We're only doing, like, I believe four this year. Ted Nugent went in April because he came into town. REO Speedwagon was right before that. I was going to do it live on stage tonight right at the end of your gig, but I know your voice is a little rough right now.
I forgot. They asked me, Voss, let me interrupt. They asked me, my manager goes, hey, at the end of the show, like, don't leave right away. You know, Favaz wants to come out and, like, you know, talk to you. He goes, it's supposed to be a surprise. I forgot.
Well, here it is. We are inducting you into the Keishi Real Rock Hall of Fame on our website. What are you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You're going into two Hall of Fames now in 1 year. What's it mean to come into the
case? Well, quite honestly, this is a lot easier than the last one. My speech is, of course. You know, the last Hall of Fame thing was really difficult because of the situation where the whole band wasn't there. But this is, it makes sense to me. I'm not as humbled about this one.
But I'm
thank you very much, and I'm definitely honored and all that, but I'm not as humbled. Because, I mean, come on, this town with me and St. Louis is the greatest thing. It's like rock and roll history, you know.
That's all really good stuff. Want to add anything?
No.
I'm done. Awesome. Thanks, Sam.
Quick stills.
Yeah, we do a couple quick stills, Sam?
Yeah, but are you shitting me?
Well, there you have Sammy's interview, that I did. And this was the Hall of Fame induction interview. It was our first podcast, John. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, I think it's over.
Okay. We're going to try to do this damn thing on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to release them on Fridays. And next week, we're going to do my interview with Paul McCartney.
Wow.
From 2002, which was funny. It ties in with Sammy. It was done on the night before I flew out for the first time in Cabo.
Uh-huh.
And actually, it was the first time I'd ever left the country, I think. So I interviewed Paul McCartney. 5 o'clock that morning, I was on a trip, to Cabo. And that's a really good one, too, that I think we'll enjoy.
And I have a side story to add to that, too. So that's next week.
All right. Thank you, man.
Thank you, Favaz.
It's the Keishi Tapes.